Alrighty, hello again, everyone, and welcome to it. It's Black Friday, baby. I hope you got out and like trampled somebody for some great deals. Bailey is here. Quinn is still here. I'm recording these both on Wednesday night. The baby doesn't need to be in the microphone. The episode today is a best of with David Petrugia about an amazing book called 1920, The Year of the Six Presidents. It's a great book. I highly, highly recommend it. Wildly entertaining and informative, and the guy can craft a narrative like you wouldn't believe. I'm jealous of his ability to write. So check that out at Amazon. It's Black Friday. I hope you're out doing something great, doing something wonderful. I hope you're not working today. I hope you're having fun with the family and getting deals, getting those doorbusters or whatever the hell it is. I probably won't get any doorbusters. I'm right now likely on my way driving back home after having spent a glorious week in Michigan relaxing as best I can, even though I still had to work. But still, it's well worth it to see the dad and to see the family. Have a wonderful Black Friday. Have a great weekend. Don't forget the Curse program, patreon.com/DerekHunterPodcast, will be live at 12:01 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 9:01 p.m. Pacific Time. Adjust accordingly in between and around the world. It'll be all new because F those people. That's why. Quinn, do you have anything to say that isn't Hello Kitty related?
Yeah, it's gone.
I'll update you next week in the quest to find the lost Hello Kitty toy that no other human being on the earth remembers except Quinn at my dad's house, which I don't think it exists, Quinn. Say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Sounds so dejected. You'd think she'd been abused and had no toys. She's neck deep in toys. Anyway, have your leftovers. Enjoy your time. And I'll see you at the Curse Show at midnight or the regular show on Monday. Thanks for listening. Today's edition of the Derek Hunter Podcast is brought to you by Ancient Life Oil.
What is full spectrum CBD? Full spectrum CBD is all the cannabinoids, which in turn gives you major effectiveness. CBD isolate is much less effective than full spectrum CBD. No herbicides, no pesticides, pure organic, non-GMO, full spectrum CBD. Where do you get the good stuff? At ancientlifeoil.com. That's ancientlifeoil.com. Buy CBD tinctures that work. That's ancientlifeoil.com.
All righty. Hello again, everyone, and welcome to it. It is the Derek Hunter Podcast for the, what the hell is it? The 9th of July, 2021. It's a Monday. It's a Friday. It's not good, Lord. I didn't mean to skip your weekend. Yes, it is a Friday. And this show, I am very, very excited to record. I was turned on. We have an author on, David Petrugia. He has a book out. He has a bunch of books out, and you should check them all out. But he has a book out, 1920, The Year of the Six Presidents. And the way he constructs this, and the way he constructs his other books, where he takes, basically, he does a biography of a year and or a moment in history. This is just an amazing piece of work. And you don't realize it, and I didn't realize it until this book, that there were really six presidents. That's the thesis of the book. There were six presidents involved in the presidential election of 1920 in one way or another, directly, indirectly, what have you. People who would become president, people who were president, people who had been president, people who died, but were a major influence and played a big role in the 1920 election. They are Warren G. Harding, Woodrow Wilson, Calvin Coolidge, Theodore Roosevelt, Herbert Hoover, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It is, and the way he strings this together, it's like a mini biography of each one of those men and the times, and they're all woven. It's just absolutely brilliant. Plus, some of the names of the people involved in these elections. I don't want to ruin it. We're going to talk to David Petruzza in a second, but I can't encourage you enough to check out the works of David Petruzza. If you try to spell his name and you're not a native Polish speaker, you might have a problem with that. So just search 1920, the year of the six presidents, and you'll find that book. And then from there, you can find the rest of his books. It's well worth your time. I've listened to it. I got the audiobook. I've listened to it three times already, and I've only had the thing for 3 or 4 months. This was brought to my attention by Dean Karyanis, yesterday's guest, and it was set up. This interview was set up in part with the help of Dean, a big part with the help of Dean. So thanks to Dean for that. Before we get to it, don't forget the Curse program. It's been, you know, non-current event shows all week. And that's going to change tomorrow at patreon.com/DerekHunterPodcast, where I will once again engage my inner obscenity-laced self and bring you the news of the week the way it deserves to be talked about. So it's only $5 a month, and it helps me out immeasurably, and you'll enjoy it. Also, let me tell you about Ancient Life Oil. Yes, ancientlifeoil.com. If you're in the market for CBD oil or CBD products, CBD creams, you don't have to take it and, you know, swallow the oil. You can get the cream. And the cream is buy one, get one free this month. So you can't beat it at ancientlifeoil.com. It's 100% pure, 100% organic CBD oil, non-GMO, all natural stuff. It really works. See what people are saying about CBD oil. See what they're saying about CBD products. And then go, I want to try that thing. So let's have a moment and try this stuff. Well, now you can get buy one, get one free on the cream. And if you enter promo code Derek at checkout, D-E-R-E-K, click apply, you get free fast shipping on top of everything else. I don't want to put this off any longer. I'm excited for you guys to get to know David Petruzza. So let's get on with the program, shall we? Let's do this thing. All right, ladies and gentlemen, as I promised earlier in the program, we are joined by author David Petruzza. He is author of more books than I've read, to be perfectly honest with you. And I have become absolutely fascinated, thanks to a mutual friend of ours and frequent guest on this podcast, Dean Karyanis, with the book 1920, The Year of the Six Presidents. And I thought, let's try and get him on. And lo and behold, he agreed to come on. I don't know what he would have gotten had he won the bet. But I'm glad he lost it. David Petruzza, thank you for taking the time today.
Good to be on.
I've got to tell, first of all, you've written a series of these books that I would categorize kind of as like a biography of a year. How would you categorize not just this, but 1932 and 1960, the books that you've written as, how would you categorize them?
Well, I'd say they're more of the election than the year as a whole. So we're not going, you know, far afield into like what's going on in Romania that year,
right?
The culture of the year, you know, what was the big popular song or on Broadway or anything like that. So it's centered on the election and on the political events that impact the election. So in 1920, it's the suffrage amendment or the rise of the Ku Klux Klan, the League of Nations, prohibition. And then in 1948, which is another one of these books that I've done, it would be the Berlin airlift or the integration of the armed services, et cetera, et cetera. So there's backstory. And in 1920, has a hell of a lot of backstory.
Yes.
People have said, you know, like, so why did you do a book on the election of Warren Harding? You know? And there's not like a lot of suspense because he got 60% of the vote. Well, it's how all that happened and what went up to it. And then, of course, the stroke and the incapacity of Woodrow Wilson that year, which makes it a very unique year.
The subtitle of 1920 is The Year of the Six Presidents, and it really, I never thought of it before until this book, but it really is an unprecedented time where there were six people heavily involved in the election, not all lived through it all, but heavily involved in the election who were or would become presidents of the United States. When did that occur to you? And was that part of the sale of deciding to write this book? Or
I've written a book previously on the gangster and gambler Arnold Rothstein. And I had an option with the publisher to do another book. And actually, I'd always followed the 1920s and the history of it and the political history of it, et cetera, et cetera. And I was doing some mental gymnastics or trivia. It wasn't strenuous enough to be called gymnastics. It was trivia. Like in 1960, you had three presidents, LBJ, Nixon, JFK. In 1964, you've got one. In 1968, you've got Nixon and Reagan. So, you know, when you get three, that's a lot until you get to like, whoa, 1920, all these guys, including T.R., Theodore Roosevelt, who, if he lives, he is the Republican nominee.
You think that's a foregone conclusion? You make that case in there, and it's pretty convincing that the Republican establishment said he's our guy, I guess, you know, reluctantly, but he was more unstoppable than desired.
He was. The big conservative guns that year were like, okay, we want to win. You know, we've cut ourselves to pieces the last two times, and this is still a Republican nation, and we'll go with a winner. We'll go with TR. And at that point, I guess who else was out there? You know, you get to Warren Harding pretty quick, or guys that we don't remember, like a Leonard Wood, who was a general in the Spanish-American War, or Frank Loudon, who was a governor of Illinois. So once TR was out of the picture, it drops off pretty fast. And Charles Evans Hughes, who was the nominee and just missed in 1916, he doesn't want to run because his daughter had just died. Death plays a large part in politics and back then. And so he was kind of bummed out and didn't want to make that ride again.
It did, and scandal played a part of it. I want to get into all of that. First, talk a little bit about Leonard Wood, because you go into detail about how, on paper, he was the guy. You know, after Roosevelt dies, he's
the heir apparent.
He's got a great biography. He's well known at the time, but why couldn't he put it over the top?
Well, because he was a political amateur. I mean, he was a very political general and had been hanging around Washington in one form or another since the Cleveland administration, which is when he met Theodore Roosevelt. And then he goes off on to fight in the Spanish-American War. And he is as much a proponent of preparedness as Theodore Roosevelt was. And he is the choice of the survivors of the Theodore Roosevelt family. So he's the guy, but he also makes a lot of mistakes in the primary, you know, and not just the primaries, but in winning the state conventions and the bosses' choices and all that. So he gets tangled up in one of those situations where the front runners beat each other to a pulp. And the bad blood is so pronounced at the end of the process at the convention that one side is not going to give up easily to another. And he does alienate people like in Ohio by going into the primaries and trying to knock off the favorite sons. You don't do that back then. There are a lot of favorite sons. I mean, this is something like Franklin Roosevelt will avoid in 1932, even though he's the front runner from very early on. It's like, I'm not going to challenge these guys in the powerful key states and alienate them. And Wood does this. And again, he's a bit of a political amateur because he's never run for office previously. And what Warren Harding and his campaign manager do is Dirty Harry Callahan in the Dirty Harry movie says a man's got to know his limitations, and both Harding and Doherty knew their limitations. They knew Harding wasn't all that popular. he was probably the number five choice of people, of the delegates, of the party, and the public at large. And so it's like, we're not going to alienate anyone. We're going to let these other guys beat each other to a pulp. And then when they've done that and they realize they have no other good option, they will turn to us. And they do that with an incredible amount of finesse.
Well, that's such a foreign concept to people today, that because you go through the ballots and ballots, and at some point you've got to explain to me how it is that the delegates can offer a half of a vote. I don't a half a vote every day. You're going through the list and then 78 and a half. Like, who the hell is the half? But I want to.
Everybody gets a seat at the table. You know, it's the local politics, and like, well, your uncle is the county chairman, so you get half of my vote or something like that. Yeah.
But on the other side of the aisle, because the book focuses a lot on the positioning of Republicans, because there are so many Republican presidents there, 4-2 in the title. But looming over all of it is the sitting president in 1920, who, quite frankly, I'd always heard about Woodrow Wilson. He just seemed like a real son of a bitch, for lack of a better word. He's negotiating the treaties, and he's the only one who shows up with no staff. He doesn't brief his staff. He keeps things from his staff. He doesn't seem to trust anybody. And it's not a matter of trust. I wouldn't say that. It's that he doesn't deem anybody except Woodrow Wilson worthy of Woodrow Wilson. Am I overstating that?
No, it's a partially trust. I mean, at the end of the process of the Treaty of Versailles, he doesn't even trust his alter ego, Colonel Edward M. House, to negotiate for him. And this is the guy who is going to, one of the 14 points is open covenants openly agreed upon. And he's not even trusting his staff with the meetings with Clemenceau and Lloyd George and Vittorio Orlando from Italy, you know, the big four of that group. So it's behind the scenes. It's a complicated thing. I mean, when you see, you know, we have Armistice Day and we think peace just happens in November 11, 1918. And the fighting which goes on, particularly in Eastern and Central Europe, for years afterwards, as people try to settle boundaries between Hungary and Romania and Poland and everybody, it's not easy. And particularly when you base these things on nationality, and it's like, who's the dominant nationality in a given locality, whether it's like Trieste or Fiume, the city is Italian, the countryside is Yugoslavian. In Lvov, Lemberg, Lviv, a town with three names, which should give you an idea of how complicated the situation is, it's a Polish and Jewish population surrounded by Ukrainians. So who gets it? It's really hard. And to think you can just go in there and fly by the seat of your pants because of some moral certitude, which Wilson always has a ton of, whether it's the president of the United States or governor of New Jersey or going back to president of Princeton, he throws people overboard because he's the guy who knows it all, knows what is right, and even when he changes positions. So when he changes positions on, you know, he kept us out of war, oops, all of a sudden we're in war. I'm against William Jennings Bryan, he's not such a bad guy, and he can be Secretary of State, and I'm against women's suffrage, and all of a sudden I'm for women's suffrage, and anybody who still holds the old position is just plain evil. So he's pretty annoying.
Will you describe how to deal with Wilson, which I found fascinating, is the advice, I forget who gave it, but it's right there in the first chapter.
It was Colonel House.
Discover a common hate. And then you can get him riled up about something you're riled up about, so he thinks you're on his team, and then that can, it for somebody who thought so much of their intellect and moral superiority, it's almost kind of funny that they have this vulnerability that's almost childlike to me.
Yeah, it is, and he being this great, he says, the public doesn't respond to me because I am bloodless and the emotional, charismatic guy is Theodore Roosevelt. And if it's between him and me, you know, in a one-on-one, it's going to be Theodore Roosevelt and not me. But yeah, he is as charged up emotionally, at least internally as anyone else. One of the things about him, which I thought of more and more as I did another book, a more recent book called TR's Last War, is how much he restrained himself. Think of TR as sort of like the Donald Trump of 1916 or 17, tweeting away, blasting away at Wilson because of the war generally. And Wilson never responding. He's holding it all in. And, you know, maybe if he didn't hold it all in, he wouldn't have had all those big strokes at the end. But, you know, maybe he should have just blown up occasionally.
What's amazing, you know, though, Roosevelt. You detail a bunch of his strokes, and his health was way worse than anybody ever let on. But he still held out the hope and almost the demand. He didn't want to campaign for a third term, but he thought the Democrats should just give it to him.
Yeah. He dispatches his Secretary of State, his third Secretary, at least Secretary of State, a guy named Bainbridge Colby, who had been an old TR supporter back in 1912, a bull most progressive, to the San Francisco Convention of the Democratic Party to stampede the party into nominating him into a third term, which is bizarre because the guy has been wheelchair bound in the White House, stroke ridden, for about a year at that point, and barely functioning, and not functioning much at all as president of the United States. And when Colby gets to San Francisco and shares this with his fellow cabinet members, they are aghast. And he says, I was treated like I was a criminal or something for coming going along with this thing. And because Wilson is harboring this pipe dream, this fantasy of a third term, he won't get out of the way. He won't get out of the way and let a real successor gather some steam to be the Democratic nominee in 1920. The logical guy, the front runner, is his son-in-law, the Secretary of the Treasury, former Secretary of the Treasury at that point, William Gibbs McAdoo. It's not a question of nepotism because McAdoo was Secretary of the Treasury and is kind of de facto campaign manager in 1912 before marrying the boss's daughter. But he was a very capable guy and
but he couldn't. Wilson
not
could
able
not
get going.
Nobody was worthy of succeeding Wilson except Wilson.
No. And then you've got A. Mitchell Palmer, who is the attorney general, who has all the Palmer raids against the radicals, the Bolsheviks, the anarchists in the first so-called Red Scare. And then there's a third guy who is basically the Democrat alter ego of Ward Harding. He's from Ohio. He's a newspaper editor, and he's holding political office there. And his strategy is the same thing. His name is James M. Cox, and his strategy is, people aren't that crazy about me, but these other guys are going to beat themselves to a pulp, and then I can walk in. His strategy makes a lot more sense than Harding's. Not that Harding's is a bad strategy. It takes Harding 10 ballots to get the nomination, which is very rare and very attenuated for the Republicans. But it goes into the 40s, 40-some ballots for Cox to get the nomination. That's because until 1936, the Democrats have what is known as the two-thirds rule. Think of it as like the filibuster rule or cloture rule in the Senate. And that means that unless you have two-thirds of the delegates, you're not going to get the Democratic nomination. And Wilson Wilson takes 40-some ballots in 1912 to get the nomination, and it takes Franklin Roosevelt multiple ballots in 1932, and in 1924, it's 103 ballots before they nominate John W. Davis as the Democrat nominee.
One of the players here, again, that you go into, because it's a biography of the election. Eugene Debs is a name most people are familiar with, but they can't really place as to why. I learned a lot about him as well, but it was so bizarre to me in reading your book, the power and the influence and the appeal and the brazenness of someone like Debs back then. You know, now they all say the third party candidates are treated as fringy lunatics. Back then, they were kind of fringy lunatics, too. But he was a serious contender and taken seriously by the media, not dismissed as a kook, and taken seriously by the other candidates as well.
He ran multiple times. He's the Socialist Party candidate. And Socialists were winning a lot of mayorships, and in that Red Scare, there are five members of the New York State Assembly who are elected on the Socialist Party ticket in those years. So they're capable of, I mean, big cities, Milwaukee, Bridgeport, Schenectady. Walter Lippmann, the famous newspaper columnist, served the socialist mayor of Schenectady in the teens before he decided, well, that's boring. I think I'll become Walter Lippmann instead, you know? And so Debs receives just about 1 million votes in 1912. Now, part of the reason for that is not only because they're peaking, and they're going to get their thunder stolen by Wilson's New Freedom, his version of the New Deal. And so they're going to go downhill. They're also going to go downhill for another reason, which has nothing to do with the Democratic Party or A. Mitchell Palmer rounding up radicals. It has to do with the Russian Revolution. And it has to do with the Communist Party. And a bunch of the socialists really were radical guys.
Yeah, to hear them, their declarations, they were down with the struggle. They wanted to bring that here.
Like, yeah, this is, you know, there's a reason why people are confusing socialists and communists in 1920, because they were confused themselves. And the statements they're coming out about a revolution and, you know, the Lenin and the Bolsheviks are the wave of the future is downright scary. So a bunch of the more radical guys form the Communist Party and take a lot of the energy with it. Now, Debs also runs again in 1920. And again, gets about 900,000 votes. What's the kicker? What's the big asterisk with that? I mean, he did that 8 years before. So what's the big deal in 1920? Well, he's in jail.
Yeah,
he's in Atlanta Federal Penitentiary because he's been convicted of the Sedition Act. He had argued, spoken against the draft. Woodrow Wilson was not going to put up with this. You know, he's not exactly the most tolerant guy. And he says, I'm never going to let this guy out of jail. Never. Warren Harding lets him out of jail so he can spend Christmas 1922 with his family, but not Woodrow Wilson. And so you get news photographers going to the prison and seeing the notification ceremony when Debs is notified formally of the nomination. He's allowed to issue statements.
It sounds like the warden liked him. Sound like the warden liked him. Yeah. He gave him all sorts of seemingly special privileges.
He did. He had some health problems, I guess, and I think he even gave him a little bit of hooch for his health. and so he was treated actually quite well, and was quite well respected by his fellow prisoners.
No,
but there's an edge to him. There's an edge to him.
He also seems joyless. He also, I mean, maybe that's not how he was, but he there's something about the portrayal of the real activist socialist communists at that time is they just seem like they have no joy in life. Like everything is, you know, well, this is for the people. I am a communist. I am a socialist through and through. The Deb speeches that you give in the book and the comments that you give in the book, and he gets mad at some. He just seems like he was, like his whole life was dedicated to the cause of socialism by 1920. Am I reading too much into that, or is it just...
No, he starts off as, you know, pretty middle-of-the-road Democrat and a union organizer, and then when they have the big Pullman strike, he ends up in jail on that. He just gets more and more working himself up to, like, well, the whole thing has to be overthrown, and we're going to take over all these industries and infrastructures and every other thing. I think one of the things they were really into was taking over abattoirs, slaughterhouses. It's like, really? We're not even hearing that from any of the radicals of today. But yeah, he is in many ways a bitter guy against the system and against the American people and against the voters. You know, he says, well, you know, the people expect to get something and then they vote against it, and, you know, basically the hell with them. And so even though he's supposedly this sweet-natured fellow with a love for all mankind, he's like, he's got an edge to him as well.
Of the six presidents involved in the 1920 race, and you would know better than I, so I'm going to ask this from a place of ignorance and just an observer through your work, it seems like there are only two of them who are decent human beings. Forget the politics, whatever their politics are. Calvin Coolidge and Hoover seem like the decent, honorable human. And I'm talking about the way they treat their wives, the way they treat their staffs. Am I wrong in that? Because Calvin Coolidge, there's no controversy. He's not caught with a maid in a room disheveled or anything like that. But Warren Harding loved the ladies, could not control himself, did not even bother to try to control himself, even after he'd kept getting a bunch of them pregnant. We all know about FDR's dalliances, Woodrow Wilson the same. I mean, as far as the human being side of them, is Coolidge and Hoover it?
Well, there's also T.R. T.R. is very Victorian in regard to sexual morals, okay? And so much so, he was determined never to remarry.
Right.
After his first wife dies. He thought that was like sinful or reprehensible, and finally, when he does it, he marries his second wife in London, of all places. Like, he didn't want anyone to know this. I don't know. But yeah, in terms of faithfulness, you have T.R., Coolidge, Hoover. Hoover does inspire the loyalty of his staff to an amazing extent. Roosevelt, Franklin, he's really a mixed bag there, because there are a lot of people in that 1920 campaign who are going to be with him all the way to 1932 and such. But then when he becomes president, you see people breaking away from him to an amazing extent. The brain trusters, his vice president, cabinet people like Jim Farley, who eventually do turn on him, but he has enough big enough coalition to start with to be able to carry that through. Harding, I think, is actually a decent, kindly person. Once you take away the dalliances,
there's a lot of them, and he keeps doing it.
There's a lot of them.
That's what I don't understand. Is
negligible.
Like nowadays.
I mean, they're not exactly the. It's not also as confused a situation as the Franklin Roosevelt White House and family structure is, which is a complete soap opera. I mean, there's something which you need an incredible flow chart to figure out who's with what and when and how and who's living in the White House or has the adjoining bedroom in the governor's mansion. That's a real mess. That almost like makes Harding look like a monk. But the with Hardy or Coolidge could be rather sharp and distant, but in terms of being upright and honest, I mean, absolutely.
But Warren Harding,
and a great public servant,
the eventual nominee and the eventual president, had. He was being blackmailed. He was being actively. How could you even consider running for president of the United States and then having to lie to all of your to many supporters who, like, when he, I think he sits down with Lodge or whatever, and he says, "Look, is there anything in your past that's going to come back to haunt you?" And he says, "No." And that's an obvious lie. Well, I mean, it's not only in his past; it's in his present.
Well, yes, his present and his future. He has an illegitimate daughter by someone who is barely a girlfriend who is barely legal. I'm not quite sure what the chronology of that was of the affair, but yes, Nan Britton, which it's not in the book because it was not resolved then. But the because the book is about 10 years old. But later on, you know, now it's like, you know, you can send away for all the DNA tests.
Yeah.
So Warren Harding had no legitimate children, but he came from a very large family. So there are Hardings and Harding DNA floating all around, I guess, the Midwest.
It was floating around back then, too.
Floating around back then, too. And so they compared the DNA of the progeny of Harding's illegitimate daughter, and to compare that to the Harding family DNA, and they did find a match. Now, the other thing about that test was this, and which is an issue we have not talked about. Toward the end of that campaign, the Democrats in Ohio come out with a bunch of hundreds of thousands of leaflets, somehow getting all around the country, as far away as San Francisco, saying Warren Harding has black blood.
Yes, that was a huge controversy. It seems so bizarre to hear it now, but they wanted to pass this around, but they also wanted their fingerprints off of it. It was a huge controversy, and even Warren Harding's own father-in-law said, "You know, my son-in-law is black."
Right, and. So Harding, and then the thing is, do you deny it? And if you deny that, then you're essentially, you have to do that very carefully because you could be insulting the African-American vote up north. So the best way, and also if you, you know, don't deny something unless you want to magnify the charges. Okay, so Harding remains silent about that, but the DNA test, which came out a few years ago, revealed that in fact, no, it wasn't true. It wasn't true that he had no African American blood in him whatsoever. So that was a false alarm, but it was it could have blown up the entire campaign, say in 1920.
It's everything that went into play in the 1920 election is fascinating because it's so foreign to us now, but it's also familiar to us too. It's the fight for power, that part we get. The rules generally are the same. It's the tactics that have changed. And as you're doing research for this book, and going through and all these characters, and you weave in, there are just hundreds of characters and anecdotes and stories and everything. Who surprised you the most, either in a good way or a bad way, that you're like, wow, I didn't know that, or I never would have figured that about this person? It doesn't have to be one of the six presidents. It can literally be anybody in the book where you're like, I've never heard of this person or barely ever heard of this person. It turns out they were wildly important, and I didn't know that before. Something like that.
I think the most surprising incident that came out of left field was at the same time the charges were coming out against Harding surreptitiously, there was a scandal or an incident breaking loose regarding Franklin Roosevelt and how he had conducted himself as Undersecretary of the Navy and investigating shall we say, some immorality at the Newport Naval Base. It involved prostitution.
You handle that very delicately.
Female and male.
You handle that very delicately, but basically the orders are to these soldiers, go find out if there are any gay soldiers out there and do it. Take it as far as you need to go, basically saying you can go have sex with them if that's what the proof you need.
Right. And this was like, everybody was like, did he really do that? And there was a congressional committee formed to investigate that, which pretty much was sat on the issue. I think the Republicans didn't know. I think it was, you know, things would be worded so guardedly in the press. I think everyone was so flummoxed by it, they didn't quite know what to do with it, except for the local newspaper editor in Rhode Island. But the committee doesn't do anything about it, and it issues a report after the election. And the headline in the New York Times is rather aghast at everything that has come out about Roosevelt. And the issue soon dies. And the issue dies maybe because it was a 48-hour story anyway at that point, or old news. But it dies because something else overshadows the story with Franklin Roosevelt. He gets polio.
Mm-hmm.
And so people, it's like, lay off him. They lay off him for a while.
But it wasn't an issue in 32, was it? Did it ever come up?
It was not an issue, and it's never an issue again, ever. Ever, really. And then Roosevelt, you know, comes back in that 1924 convention to nominate Al Smith, and hobbles up to the platform on crutches. He's still on crutches then. He hasn't quite maneuvered or finessed the way to get about, so it looks like he's not crippled.
Mm-hmm.
That comes later. There's, you know, all the photographs, he might be leaning on a couple of canes or on his son James's shoulders or against the platform. They would literally, when he was president, ramp up entire blocks of city streets so he could get up a ramp to a stairway. I mean, literally, the crazy big ways so you could never see what the problem was with him. Or he would speak from the back of a car with a special stand attached to it. So it really is, the issue is, it's like, well, he has a problem, and it's not really explained entirely. And also, he never deals with it personally. He always thinks if he just gets a little more therapy, he'll be fine, which is a pipe dream, but, you know, it's a false hope. But, you know,
I don't know why he kept going to Warm Springs
for it, but it's like, you know, sometimes false hope is better than no hope at all.
Yeah.
And good for him if he thought he could, you know, not just wallow in it. That's the great thing about Franklin Roosevelt, that he does surmount that. And when you read the details of the stuff he has to go through in his everyday life, it's like, wow. I mean, how he dealt with that is amazing.
Would you classify Warren Harding as corrupt or far too trusting?
Not personally corrupt. I don't think there's any real evidence of that. He does make a number of bad appointments. Albert B. Fall, as Secretary of the Interior, is going to sign off some oil leases to some oil industry magnates for bribes, essentially, and goes to federal prison. Fall is not really suspect. His nomination before the Senate, he had been a senator from, and a progressive Republican senator from New Mexico, is not controversial. It goes through in 5 minutes, I think. I mean, literally 5 minutes through the United States Senate. So it's like, you know, okay, he didn't know that, but the Veterans Administration scandal, which gets overlooked, there's billions looted by his appointee, a guy named Forbes. Now, whether he had reason to suspect Forbes or not, I don't know. The guy he had reason to suspect was his campaign manager. Daugherty, Harry Daugherty, and everyone is just, you know, kind of cringing about him from the beginning. But it's a question of loyalty. I mean, this is the guy who brought me to the dance, so I guess I'm going to take care of him. But Daugherty is involved in, you know, all sorts of nefarious things as Attorney General. He does not go to jail, but he's acquitted in legal proceedings, but no one quite believes he's an innocent at all. So you have a series of those guys. And then with his death, with Harding's death, he can't defend himself. And at the same time as these scandals are popping one after another, you have the book come out from his mistress, Nan Britton, called The President's Daughter. And it's a book which is privately printed, gets, you know, passed around under the table, but sells like hotcakes. And all of these things cumulatively absolutely torpedo his reputation. At his death, he was phenomenally popular.
He won in a landslide.
In San Francisco, he wins in a landslide. I'm sure he would have won again in 1924. He dies in San Francisco, and the train that carries his body back to Washington and then back up to Ohio, there are people in the middle of the night, in the middle of nowhere, lining the train tracks to, you know, to see it pass by. He's quite beloved at that point, but, you know, his popularity is just nosedives after his death and has never recovered.
When you look,
you know, one fellow who gives him a fairly good biography is John W. Dean.
Really?
Yes, there was a series of short little bios of the presidents done a few years ago, edited by Arthur Schlesinger, and they picked John Dean to do Harding. Now, why was that? Was it because of Republican corrupt people?
Mm.
Okay. It was because John Dean was from Marion, Ohio. So he was a fan of Harding. Another fellow who was from Marion, Ohio, was the other great Socialist Party presidential candidate, Norman Thomas. Norman Thomas had been a paper boy for Harding's paper, the Marion Star. He probably knew Harding's wife better because she ran a lot of the business for Harding. Harding also has a reputation of being a horrible speaker. I think largely based on a few lines from H.L. Mencken, who could, you know, skewer people in his sleep, and talked about Harding's inaugural address and how bad it was. But Harding made a good chunk of his living as a professional speaker on the Chautauqua circuit, going around the country and giving speeches for money. People would pay to hear people like William Jennings Bryan and Debs and Harding on the campaign, not on the campaign trail, you know, sometimes on the campaign trail, but in person, live, sort of like a political vaudeville. And Harding was judged to be a pretty good speaker.
And so apparently was Calvin Coolidge, even though he seemed
Coolidge
to hate it.
Coolidge was actually, well, Coolidge as a speaker, no. and you can see you're seeing more of these things now on YouTube. And actually, one of the first sound film of a president is of Coolidge reading off some remarks. They're good remarks on the White House lawn in like 1924 or 5 or so. And then there's some newsreels of him later. I mean, he is not a vibrant speaker at all. But he is a terrific writer. He's a great stylist. I recommend to everyone, whether you care about his politics or about 1920s history or whatever, to read his autobiography to learn a clean, crisp style of writing, occasionally punctuated by real poetry almost. And his his words impromptu after the 1927 New England flood, where he's talking about the state of Vermont. It's called "Vermont is a State I Love," is really poetic. So he's quite the wordsmith, but his delivery is not exactly a Franklin Roosevelt or Wilson or even Harding.
Well, Franklin Roosevelt
maybe
was
as good as Hoover. Hoover was just dreadful as a public speaker.
Well, Franklin Roosevelt was good on script. He was apparently awful off the cuff, though.
Well, I don't know. I don't know about off the cuff. Now, what he would do, particularly later in the game, well, he would be off the cuff in the 1920 campaign. He was making a bunch of gaffes, and by gaffes, not always where he told the truth, but where he was exaggerating his own role. The FDR of 1920 is not the FDR of 1932. He is not ready for prime time. And in Montana, he's boasting that he had, run operations in Haiti and Nicaragua, occupying these places with American troops and writing their constitutions. He's also giving a speech early on in Brooklyn, where he's talking about how much he was sabotaging his boss, Josephus Daniels, Secretary of the Navy, and doing all sorts of things behind his back for armed naval preparedness in the run-up to World War One, which is like just crazy. He was lucky that Daniels was had such forbearance and did not just can him. Woodrow Wilson was about ready to can him too, but he came very close to that. So yeah, he could be reckless off the cuff back then. When he gets to the presidency, he has this. It's like a movie studio, and how the movies in the 30s, and I guess even now, would have a team of primary writers, and then it would people coming in and additional dialogue by, et cetera, et cetera. So his speeches are not written by himself, but he's capable of adding additional words and phrases to them, but it's the delivery, Clark Gable or Cary Grant may not have written the lines, but they knew how to deliver them.
Yeah.
And he knew how to deliver them, and he would practice them over and over and over again. And in the 1930s, as president, he would hire, he would get transcripts, which were not easy, or recordings of his speeches over the radio so he could listen to them. Not from egotism, but so he could practice and hone his delivery even more, and know what sort of things worked, where to pause, where they emphasize something, et cetera, et cetera. So he was a great performer in that way. And Sam Rosenman, his primary speechwriter for almost all his career, said, yeah, he would have different speechwriters at different points of time, but every speech was essentially an FDR speech. I mean, he made it his own. He would also do something really weird, like at the 1932 convention, where Rosenman might deliver a draft of a speech, and then Ray Moley might deliver a draft, or Louis McHenry Howe would deliver a version of what he should say, and he would just take pages from each one on his way to the podium and put them all together.
Mad Libs before his time. Let me ask you this, David Patricia, last question, just out of curiosity, since you are the expert on the 1920 election. Those six men on the cover of your book, if they were all on the ballot simultaneously, and all things being equal, Teddy Roosevelt obviously was alive, of those six men, who would have been elected?
Of those six?
Yeah.
T.R. If he was alive, he's
easily
elected. Yeah. Another interesting thing is, and I found this out in my T.R.'s last war book research, that Harding, who had blasted T.R. in the 1912, the war of 1912, contretemps between the conservative Republicans, the stand pat Republicans, and the progressives, was very much for Taft and was doing something very unusual for him. He was blasting TR by name and all sorts of name calling. But in the run-up to World War One, Harding and Roosevelt reconcile. And I think you might have seen a T.R. Harding ticket in 1920, which would have been a race to see which candidate had the worst health and who was going to die first. You know, neither one of those guys made it to 1924.
No, and a lot of these guys were in ill health, and they weren't all that old. That was what was shocking to me. You think of Teddy Roosevelt, and you think, well, he had to have died at, like, 87 years old. But no, just looking at the pictures.
Like 62 or something.
Right, and very young.
Franklin dies about the same age. And it's amazing that Woodrow Wilson outlives Harding.
It's amazing Woodrow Wilson lived at all. I mean, he was a disaster and having strokes for years.
Yep, but he hangs on until about 1924. He thinks he might be able to come back in 1924. And as for healthy living, the guy who looks the worst from a physical standpoint, being a real pudge ball and looking bloated for most of his life, Herbert Hoover lives to be 90 years old. Where a guy like Calvin Coolidge, who looks sort of thin and in good health, dies. He would not, if he ran again in 1928, he would not have lived to his full term, because he dies in January of 1933, and his term would have ran until March before they changed the inauguration date in 1936. So a lot of these guys, in terms of health, you take a look going all the way back to Chester Arthur with Bright's disease and cancer of the jaw with Grover Cleveland and McKinley being shot and his wife being sick and Nellie Taft having a stroke and Woodrow Wilson's first wife dying and the Wilson strokes and Harding dying and Florence Harding being sick. You know, there's a run of tremendous ill health and tragedy in the White House running up to this period.
It's amazing.
You would not want to sell life insurance.
No, it's amazing anybody lived through it. And you think about it, there were very. Now we're used to having, you know, 4, 5, 6 ex-presidents living at a time. It's like maybe 2 in a good year, and they're just dropping dead back then.
Yeah, the previous time when you had a bunch of presidents was right at the time of the Civil War. You had an amazing number of guys. A fellow named Chris DeRose did a book about this called The President's War. And, you know, you had John Tyler, Millard Fillmore, Pierce Buchanan, all floating around at this time. And all on various sides. I mean, Tyler joins the Confederacy.
One of the things I love about this book is the names. I mean, the information is awesome, too. But the names, like, you know, my favorite name of all time now is Bainbridge Colby.
That's a great name.
Tell me about Bainbridge Colby, because it's just a fascinating. What do you call somebody named Bainbridge? Is there a short version? You call him Bain? Do you call him Bridge? What do you call him?
I don't know what they call him, but he is one of the many fellows who turns on Franklin Roosevelt by 1936. What I was saying earlier is Roosevelt can keep people on board in some ways, but in other ways he does not. So people who were supporting him, maybe grudgingly, maybe not, in 1932, like Al Smith, the 1928 Democratic nominee, or John W. Davis, the 1924 nominee, are joined by Bainbridge Colby. Colby, by this time, is working for William Randolph Hearst, who is the fellow who put Franklin Roosevelt over the top in 1932 at the convention by switching his delegates in California and then in Texas to put him over the top. But so Colby is generally determined to be kind of a stooge of Woodrow Wilson and not a very impressive fellow. But Colby, within a matter of a few years, goes from being a TR Republican to running for United States Senate in 1914 as the progressive Bull Moose candidate to them being the Democrat Secretary of State for Woodrow Wilson, and then he leaves the Democratic Party essentially to against Woodrow Wilson, as a lot of the old progressives tended to be very sour on Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, including a guy who was very powerful with Wilson, a guy named Newton D. Baker, Secretary of War, but he never actually comes out against Franklin Roosevelt. So we jump ahead, but all of this is really connected, and one of the great connects between 1920 and the ultimate rise of Franklin Roosevelt is he collects a card file as he's going around the country, going around running for vice president in this ill-fated campaign, and keeps in touch with everyone he's met from 1920 to 1932 on, and he actually says in 1932, this was the basis of my winning the presidency now.
You are a fountain of information, David Petrucia. The book, 1920, The Year of the Six Presidents, is I've listened to it three times. I got the audio version, and you were kind enough to send me the hardcover signed. I've listened to it three times. The story is amazing. The way you weave together all of these different stories is, my hat's off to you, sir. And thank you so much for taking the time today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, there you go. Another week in the can. David Petrucia, the book 1920, The Year of the Six Presidents. I highly recommend it. Absolutely, positively. I've literally listened to it on audiobook three times so far, and it will be listened to again. It's just chock full of information and done so well altogether. All right. Don't forget about the Curse Program, patreon.com/Derek Hunter Podcast. Tomorrow morning or tonight, depending on where you are, at 12:01 Eastern Time. Otherwise, we'll be back on Monday with a normal, back to normal show as I return from wherever it was I was. I hope you had a great weekend and had a great week. I'll see you tomorrow.